Few people truly value their assets in their minds to be no more than what they would fetch in a distress fire sale tomorrow morning. People tend to presume that normality will continue and will allow them to liquidate at advantageous prices and in an orderly fashion, without even alerting anyone else of the need to sell. Calculating total value of goods in the total economy. Look again at the young customer. His balance sheet when he wandered into the mall might look like this. Cash in hand, or pocket to be precise, equals $20. The total value found within this mini-economy would be the sum of the wealth of the store owner, $15, and the young man's wealth, $20, for a total of $35. Now you must create a post-transaction balance sheet. Again, ignoring all other assets, after the friendly transaction, the wealth of the shoe store proprietor consists of a $20 bill in her cash register. How about the young man? How much wealth does he have? Well, that would be the value of the shoes in his eyes. One way of finding out that value would be to find out how much he might be able to sell those shoes for at a garage sale. Although an accountant might prefer that method, the young man has no intention of selling his shoes. So the garage sale price would not be an accurate picture of his financial well-being. Actually, using the conventional form of appraisal would mean that virtually every purchase makes one poorer, and the logical approach would be never to purchase anything at all. Of course, you know that driving a newly purchased car out of the dealer's lot means that you cannot get your exact purchase price back. If just then you needed to convert the car back into money, you would find that you have lost many dollars by owning a new car for an hour. In this scenario, your wealth has been drastically diminished by purchase of an automobile. Your balance sheet will show that you are poorer for your purchase. However, the only reasons for having to immediately sell your new car are that you planned very badly and bought a vehicle you couldn't afford, or that the economy took a downturn and you needed the value found within your new car for food. Remember the role of faith. You don't invest, purchase, or even marry on the basis of the world coming to an end. While putting away savings for the inevitable rainy day, you operate on the presumption that tomorrow will be better than today. Rain may fall, but it will be a sprinkle, not a Noah's flood. Therefore, there is no reason to value your new car on the basis of what some mean used car dealer might give you were you in dire straits. Instead, you can safely value it at the figure it deserves in your life. Ancient Jewish wisdom teaches that this is one very valid way to evaluate your wealth. Most people do not sell their cars shortly after buying them. Instead, they enjoy driving them. They lavish care on their vehicles, taking great pride in owning them. This style of bookkeeping shows that the manner of calculating your wealth is to ask yourself how much you would accept in return for parting with your new car. Similarly, you can now evaluate the young man's wealth by means of another little thought experiment. Imagine walking up to him as he exits the mall. "Would you please sell us those scintillating shoes for $20?" you ask him. He refuses. Why should he sell them? He wants such a pair of shoes and would only have to return to the store to buy another pair. So you up the ante. "Would you please sell your shoes for $25? "Not worth it," he thinks. $5 isn't enough to cover the time and trouble of returning to the store. Perhaps that vendor won't have any more pairs in his size. Forget it. However, you persist. "How about selling them for $30? Now he hesitates. He can make a profit of $10, and most likely the store only a few yards away will have another pair in stock. But he thinks to himself, if these people are so eager for my shoes, perhaps they'll be willing to pay even more. All right, I'll sell them to you, he might say, but for $35. You probably don't want them for $35. Truth be told, you don't want them at all. Remember that you are simply conducting an experiment which you have just successfully concluded. You have discovered that the value for those shoes on his balance sheet is $35. Now you must calculate the total post-transaction value found within this mini-economy. That would be the sum of the wealth of the store owner, which is the $20 in her cash register, and the young man's wealth, composed of a pair of shoes he values at $35, giving a total of $55. Here is a table showing the wealth of the mini-system both before and after the transaction. Before transaction, customer has $20. Store owner has $15. Together, they have $35. After transaction, customer has $35. Store owner has $20. Together, they have $55. The customer has gained $15 by the transaction, whereas the storekeeper has gained $5. The aggregate increase in wealth in the mini-system is $20. Remember that emotional satisfaction has value, too. The customer possesses an emotional attachment to his shoes, whereas to the storekeeper, that same pair of shoes was merely part of her trading inventory. For this reason, goods are often worth even more to the customer than they are to the supplier who sold them in the first place. However, the trading incentive is diminished if the dealer falls in love with her inventory and becomes reluctant to part with it. How Jewish tradition assesses the value of possessions. The importance of distinguishing between your personal possessions and your trading inventory was emphasized to Jews more than 2,000 years ago when Rabbi Isaac admonished, "A person should always keep his money in three parts, one-third in real estate, one-third in merchandise, and one-third in readily available cash." This remains good advice today. First, owning some real estate is viewed not only as a wise economic step, but also as helpful for personal growth. The good Lord makes more people, but he doesn't make more land. The resulting rise in the value of real estate owned helps to impart a sense of purposeful destiny to its owner. Second, Rabbi Isaac's advice is obvious for those who own stores or who are active in other businesses requiring investment in inventory. However, even people holding down regular office jobs, for instance, can also benefit from this wisdom. For example, investing part of one's assets in movable property that can be sold and traded is sound conduct. Today, vast armies of people augment their income by developing an expertise in Victorian porcelain figurines, old firearms, antique furniture, or almost anything else. They purchase these items at estate sales and garage sales, and then sell them at a profit on the internet or at fairs and flea markets. Quite apart from the potential for gain in having some of your assets in this kind of tradable merchandise, is the benefit you realize from being constantly reminded that you are a business professional. This kind of leisure time trading activity that starts off as a hobby for many folks often ends up causing wonderful changes in people's fortunes. Third, keeping part of one's assets in cash allows one to be prepared for emergencies. It also allows one to exploit unexpected opportunities. Remember that shoe store? Now imagine that several young men crowded into it at the same time, all lusting for the last remaining pair of psychedelic sneakers. The storekeeper might well decide that the best way to determine who gets the shoes is to see who wants them most. One way to measure desire is to find out who will bid the most money for them. In all probability, the price would have been driven higher than $20. Now, let's imagine the storekeeper postponing the conclusion of the auction till the next day. With grumbles, the footwear fetishists leave the store and promise to be back in the morning. Overnight, the proprietor evaluates her wealth and feels certain that the mere demand for her merchandise has increased the bottom line of her balance sheet. This example is not that different from all those stock market investors who gleefully estimated their high net worth based on what they saw as high demand for the shares they owned. Even such important numbers as the market capitalization of public companies depends on the feelings that a large number of people have about the stock of those companies. Were large numbers of people to suddenly vanish off the face of the earth, one certain consequence would be a substantial drop in the value of those shares. As you can see, human interaction can produce wealth once you get accustomed to seeing things through the eyes of cosmic truth, even if it is a little unconventional. One of the great internet success stories has been eBay.com, whose business plan called for it to become quite simply an electronic peddler. It has done so and thrived. Consider the role of the old-fashioned peddler coming through the village. From one family, he purchases an old table that has sat unused in their basement for years. To them, it is junk, so they happily accept the $10 the peddler offers them. He later sells that piece of furniture to another family who needs just that size table and doesn't mind the scars from years of usage. Instead of spending $60 on a new table, they consider themselves fortunate to acquire this one for $20. Again, compute the value brought to the village by the passage of this one peddler. The first family is now $10 richer than they had been. The second family has $40 in their bank account that they no longer need to spend on a new table. The peddler has $10 he didn't have before. By simply facilitating one transaction, the peddler has added to the aggregate wealth of the community by a total of $60. Now, multiply this effect by the vast number of transactions facilitated by eBay, and you can easily see how the company is succeeding by creating value. Jewish tradition espouses the movement of money. Money helps to create additional wealth by moving from person to person. If, as a result of economic anxiety, people place all their money in their mattresses and keep it there, the system begins to wind down and experiences a recession or worse. One of the terms used for money in Hebrew is zuz, which actually means to move. Money must be kept moving. I must trade, which means allowing someone else to do those things for me that I do not do effectively myself. In this way, I can increase value for everyone. The late leader of the Lubavitch Hasidic movement based in Brooklyn, New York, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, well understood the secrets of money. Open quote. I was privileged to meet with him privately in 1974, and we discussed some of these matters. I gained much understanding from him. Close quote. As part of his blessing to people, he was accustomed to distribute $1 bills. More than one spectacularly successful entrepreneur attributes his success largely to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his dollar bill. During the Rebbe's lecture delivered during the Jewish holiday of Tabernacles in 1983, he said, "People are different, differently endowed with talents, resources, and opportunities. Money can deepen these differences when it is used to hoard wealth, reward privilege, and exploit the needy. But money is far more suited to unite and equalize. It is the ultimate abstractor, converting goods, talents, and toil into a commodity that can easily be traded and shared. It is a medium of generosity and cooperation between men and between nations, a consolidator of resources to a common end. Here's another real-world example of the importance of keeping money in motion. In December 1995, when fire destroyed the Massachusetts plant where he manufactured the Polartec fabric used in outdoor clothing, 70-year-old Aaron Feuerstein did not pocket the $300 million insurance payout and call it quits. Instead, he kept all the idled employees on payroll and set about rebuilding his factory. At the dedication of the new plant, Feuerstein, an Orthodox Jew, offered this Hebrew prayer. I thank you, majestic God of the universe, for restoring to Malden Mills and its employees our life and soul. A rebuilt factory is their life and soul? Yes, Aaron Feuerstein got it right. Earning one's living is inextricably bound up with a human's life and soul. Money is the key. To succeed in this noble endeavor of creating wealth, you must know money in general, and also specifically come to know your own. Paradoxically, like love, money is best won by renouncing a need to totally possess. The more fixated people are upon both money and love, the more trouble they seem to have finding them. For money, at least, an easy remedy exists. Ceremonially release your grip on your money through regular acts of charity. If the concept of charity did not exist, those who seek wealth would need to invent it. Philanthropy is as necessary for creating wealth as sunshine is for growing flowers. The next chapter will explore this fascinating relationship and how to use it in your quest. Your path to prosperity. Regardless of your past performance in this area, turn over a new leaf and start developing your trustworthiness. Trust is essential to any monetary system and to successful wealth creation. Promise less than you deliver is the advice of Rabbi Hillel in Sayings of the Fathers, and it is good advice for us all. In other words, always do more for other people than they expect. Not only will you surprise and delight them, but you will be setting the stage for enhancing your business effectiveness. For example, establish an almost inviolable rule for yourself that you always return calls within 24 hours. Respond carefully and specifically to questions and requests from family members and associates. Some people hope to postpone unpleasant confrontation by responding vaguely and ambiguously to a request instead of simply saying no. Their family members or associates misinterpret the verbal waffling to have meant the agreement or the concession they sought. When you later attempt clarification, you come across as evasive and untrustworthy. It is just as important for you to appear trustworthy in your own eyes as it is to appear so in the eyes of others. You must think of yourself as an upright kind of person, which you can do only if you really are trustworthy. Learn a specific and very valuable new skill, namely how to read financial statements. At the very least, become more familiar with them. Please don't dismiss this important component to the Ten Commandments program. On your time management plan, dedicate some serious time over the next few months to mastering this important skill. You should be able to achieve this goal on your own with the help of a good book, such as John Tracy's How to Read a Financial Report. You might be tempted to neglect this step, thinking that you are not about to become an accountant. That would be a mistake. Mastering this vital skill starts you on the road to visualizing yourself as a successful business professional. Once you have studied the material and practiced the exercises in the book you choose, send away for the annual reports of several public companies. It does not really matter which companies, although it would be more interesting if they were companies active in industries that interest you. Make sure that you receive and understand the cash flow statement. Public companies are required to release them once each quarter. Work your way through them slowly, making certain at every step that you understand what is being conveyed. It is not hard to do. It's just basic arithmetic once you have caught on to the concepts. If you have trouble, find a friendly accountant, or if necessary, enroll in an evening accounting course at a local college. Prepare and maintain your own personal financial statements. Your statements don't have to be of major accounting firm quality. You might already have prepared your annual and monthly budgets and cash flow statements, as well as your balance sheet. If not, you should now do so. Either of the two major personal accounting packages, Quicken by Intuit or Money by Microsoft, will help you develop an accurate financial picture. You need to know your money, and this is how to know it. You need to know your exact financial situation, because that is what you are intending to improve. You can hardly measure improvement if you have no way of keeping score. Finally, examine your figures monthly. Search for your own tropical island on which to successfully market your goods and services. A dentist I once knew sold his practice to sail around the world for a couple of years. He had hoped to augment his income en route by practicing his craft. Unfortunately, most of the remote islands he visited lacked electricity to operate his high-tech tools and instruments. Furthermore, their inhabitants had little interest in the cosmetic dentistry that had been his specialty. He quickly discovered, however, that he possessed another skill that was far more valuable in the palm tree encircled boat anchorages he frequented. His hobby of scuba diving allowed him to do underwater repairs and lost anchor retrievals for his fellow yachtsmen. Back home in Seattle, scuba diving would not have earned him anything at all. Among the South Sea Islands, his dental diploma was worthless. You, too, possess skills, aptitudes, and experience in which lie real value, provided you locate the people to whom your merchandise would be most valuable. The Ninth Commandment. Act rich. Give away 10% of your after-tax income. Through the mystical alchemy of money, giving charity jumpstarts wealth creation. Hannah Banz worked as a professional storyteller, using her dramatic skills to excite both children and adults about Jewish history and traditions. To drum up business, she developed a mailing list of synagogues and religious schools to which she sent regular advertising mailings. Her very first paid job was for a local synagogue. She describes it as having been such an embarrassing disaster that she removed that institution's address from her future mailings, knowing that it would never hire her again. Hannah said, "The life of an artist can be precarious, and besides telling stories, I did temporary work to make ends meet. Every month I paid my bills, but sometimes it was a real struggle. I knew of the Torah rule about tithing from my earnings, but in my financial position, I didn't see how I could possibly give 10%. I rationalized that since I was performing for Jewish charitable organizations, I was giving time instead of money." Then one evening, she found herself inspired by a speaker who explained the value of tithing from one's income. On the spot, she decided she would donate to charity 10% of the fees from her very next storytelling job, which is exactly what she did. A few days later, Hannah received a phone call from the synagogue where she had given that first miserable performance. "We've built a new sanctuary and we'll be dedicating it. Will you tell stories at our dedication? I'm afraid all we can offer is X number of dollars," the lady on the phone told Hannah, mentioning a fee far higher than she would have asked. A coincidence? Perhaps. But Hannah believes not. That wasn't the only job that came in unexpectedly. Within weeks of deciding to give away 10% of my storytelling income, that income doubled. And the principle has proven to be true in the ensuing years. As long as I tithe, my freelance income is reliable. If I forget, it dries up. All religious traditions stress the importance of giving to charity. However, Judaism's impact on its followers is augmented by its unique approach to charity. The Midrash on the Book of Proverbs, for instance, insists that if you see someone donating to charity, be assured that his wealth is increasing. The almost impenetrable textbook of Jewish mysticism, the esoteric Zohar, states, "He who donates much to charity becomes richer because of it, inasmuch as he opens up a channel for God's blessing to reach him." What is the value of these ancient statements of faith to a modern and perhaps even secularized business professional? Just this. They have survived as part of a living culture of oral transmission. That means something. It means they have passed the test of credibility. Let me explain. Watch people walking down a sidewalk on which a ladder has been set to lean against the second story of the adjacent building. The easiest passage is directly along the sidewalk and under the ladder. Yet, as you watch, you will observe most pedestrians avoiding that route, preferring the narrow and congested passage outside the foot of the ladder. Is this because everyone is superstitious and recalls that walking under a ladder brings bad luck? I don't think this adequately explains everyday behavior. The real reason that most of us avoid walking beneath a ladder is not superstition, but common sense. The superstition followed reality. It did not cause it. Over the years, enough people walking beneath a ladder were struck by a tool dropped by a careless workman aloft. Large enough numbers of people who ignored their grandmother's admonitions not to walk beneath a ladder collected a dollop of paint on their heads. Little by little, over perhaps hundreds of years, the culture absorbed the lesson. It is indeed bad luck to walk beneath a ladder. Far fewer people avoid black cats. This is because no cause and effect has been observed by rational people over the years between black cats and bad luck. Only a small number of loopy and superstitious cranks worry about black cats, but nearly everybody worries about walking under ladders for very good reason. Similarly, over hundreds of years, well, actually thousands, the connection between giving charity and increased wealth has been observed. Ancient Jewish wisdom is not prescribing a behavior as much as it is describing a reality. Giving money away increases the wealth of the donor. People who are part of an orally transmitted culture know this to be true. Too much anecdotal evidence keeps popping up. Many Jews are still raised today knowing that giving charity is not only a good thing to do, but is also a rather smart thing for ambitious people to do. If you seek out philanthropic friends, you too will hear accounts that appear to mysteriously link effect to cause, the effect of wealth caused by giving charity. Why people give to charity, even when it's not rational. Stephen Landsberg, an immensely readable professor of economics at the University of Rochester, has written on charitable giving. Surveys show that about two-thirds of U.S. households give to charity and that they tend to spread their giving among a number of different causes. On the surface, this seems a little irrational, because in giving, unlike investing, diversifying makes little sense. Donors could increase the impact for the cause in which they most believe by channeling all of their giving to that one cause. Yet, as irrational as it may be, most people continue giving of their income to a number of different causes. The reason is that they don't always base their decisions, particularly economic decisions, on purely rational grounds. The same person who yesterday drove across town to purchase a dress at a sale might well pay away yesterday's savings today in the fee at a parking lot, instead of parking at a metered space 3 or 4 blocks away. Rationality is a poor tool to use in trying to understand how people interact with money. Imagine a chef trying to determine whether his oven is working by using a thermometer taken from a steel manufacturing plant. Because it only registers temperatures from 1,000 degrees to 2,500 degrees, it won't budge when placed in the cook's 400-degree oven, misleading him into believing that his oven is faulty. Of course, his oven is fine. He was simply using the wrong instrument. Or consider the case of an engineer trying to determine whether any radio waves are penetrating into a shielded room. He could carry an ordinary portable AM radio into his sanctuary and determine that no radio signals in the frequency range of about 500 kilohertz to 1600 kilohertz are present. But that particular instrument would fail to inform him of whether other kinds of radio waves were present. Rationality is an excellent instrument for solving puzzles and paradoxes, but it is rather less effective when used to explain human behavior. Even Professor Landsberg once told Forbes columnist Dan Seligman, who had asked him whether he gave to charity, "Yes, I do, and I can't figure out why." It is interesting that the study of economics used to be undertaken in the religious studies departments of universities, rather than in their science departments. I see this as more appropriate because religion probably provides more insight into human behavior than science does. Human beings are not robots. They are entirely unpredictable people. Nowadays, economics is treated as if it were a science, although to be sure, it is called the dismal science. What the study of economics does is make scientists dismal at their inability to plumb the unpredictable ways that people behave with their money. Take just one of many studies that highlight human irrationality when it comes to money. A study published in the French Annales d'Economie et des Statistiques is called "Are People Willing to Pay to Reduce Others' Incomes?" The experiment involved grouping subjects into clusters of 4 people each, who were all given equal sums of money. The 4 had to gamble in random, computerized games that were arranged so that 2 of the 4 always came out ahead, while the other 2 lost money in each round. Richer or poorer, each subject was then given the opportunity to spend some of his or her money to reduce the take of the fellow subjects. Doing so would not only fail to make the individual subject richer, but it would actually cost between 2 and 25 cents for every dollar of his or her fellow player's money that was destroyed. The researchers were certain that no rational person would spend money merely to impoverish others. They were shocked to find that even at the top price of 25 cents for every dollar burnt, 62% of the participants paid for the privilege of making their peers poorer. One obvious conclusion of this study is that wealth is relative. Within the closed system of that game, burning your friend's wealth is making you richer, relatively richer. At a cost of only 25 cents, destroying a dollar of your friend is almost a bargain. The other and more important conclusion is that people do seem to behave unpredictably and often irrationally about money. They behave the same way about matters of love, too. That is because attraction and love are so subjective. They depend on human uniqueness, and money does, too. Being far more of a spiritual than a physical commodity, each person relates to money in his or her own special and unique way. In certain ways, we act similarly to one another. Few of us literally burn cash by tossing it into the fire, but many people spend it in ways that others consider little improvement over burning it. Jewish tradition teaches that charitable giving benefits the giver. Jewish tradition teaches its adherents that many of its required actions are for reflexive reasons. For instance, the Bible is emphatic about prohibiting cruelty to animals. Urging kindness to animals is not because Judaism views animals as independent beings with rights, not to be molested or subjected to any cruel treatment. Instead, Judaism warns that inflicting cruelty on animals brings about a coarsening of the human personality. You must be kind to animals, because doing so turns you into a more sensitive and more vital person. Jews are even instructed in how they ought to behave toward certain inanimate objects. Again, this is not because the inanimate object cares about how it is treated. It is because someone who is careful about how she interacts with even inanimate objects is someone who will become super sensitive about how she interacts with people. Finally, there is the example in which the Bible prohibits cursing a deaf man. Although the disabled victim does not hear the invective being hurled in his direction, it is still forbidden behavior, because cursing anyone does more harm to the curser than to the recipient. In similar fashion, Jews give money away regardless of how much the government is doing to solve a problem. They give money away regardless of whether they actually would be doing more social good by investing those funds in a profit-seeking venture capital fund. They also give money away regardless of the fact that sometimes people who actually make use of the supported facilities could easily foot the bill. They give money away because on some deep level, they recognize that doing so does more for the giver than it does for the recipient. Jews do not give money away because it is always rational to do so. But in spite of the fact that it is often irrational, Jews give money away not because it is rational, but because it is right. It is part of the traditional way of life in the United States. People often confuse cause and effect. They err in believing that Americans give so much more away to charity than do the citizens of other countries because U.S. tax laws make gifts non-taxable. On the contrary, U.S. tax law was constructed in this fashion precisely because it reflected a fundamental belief already held by many citizens. This belief was that religious charities, and in the early days all charities were religious, were not to be taxed. Nevertheless, today, about half of all U.S. charitable dollars go to religious causes. The devoutly Christian founders of the United States based their views on the biblical verses describing Joseph taking charge of Egyptian economic affairs during the 7 years of plenty and the subsequent 7 years of famine. To stimulate economic productivity, Joseph not only lowered the tax rate to 20%, but he also exempted the priests from all taxation. Another error in confusing cause and effect is the mistaken belief that having wealth enables charitable giving. Many really do believe that the United States is the most charitable nation in the world, because it is also the wealthiest. In reality, charitable giving contributes to wealth creation. It is far more likely that the United States evolved into history's greatest wealth-creating machine because of its deeply ingrained cultural habit of giving. This is true not only on a national scale, but also on a personal level. One of the most important habits that anyone interested in increasing wealth should acquire is giving away money. This appears to be paradoxical. Accumulating money would appear to be easier if you held on to every dollar you receive rather than following this irrational advice. Yet, it is good advice. It may be irrational, and it may even be counterintuitive, but it is good advice. Here's how it actually works. Don't live beyond your means. Instead, give beyond your means. Suppose you have begun viewing yourself as a business professional. Suppose you have identified the fields in which you would like to contribute to the well-being of your fellow citizens. Suppose you have effectively proclaimed what these fields are so that people can find you when they need you. Suppose you have started finding ways to make yourself twice as valuable and useful to your employer. Suppose you believe in the intrinsic morality of business. You yearn to lead, and you are sensitive to the future. It would be hard to deny that you have absorbed the lessons of this volume. Just as you thought you had it all down, just as you expected a Niagara-like cascade of increased income, you now hear that you ought to separate a proportion of your newfound revenue and give it away. Could anything sound more counterproductive? Giving money away makes more come back to you. People are suspicious of doing business with desperate people. I am sure that on occasion you have found yourself at the hands of a salesperson who is painfully and transparently desperate to make the sale. Unless you were equally desperate to acquire the product or service, I am sure you did not buy from that salesperson. Desperate people make others uncomfortable. Apart from anything else, their pathetic eagerness makes others doubt the value of the prospective purchase. One of the invaluable services performed by professional realtors who sell houses is that they insulate the buyer from the seller's visible eagerness to sell. The buyer feels far more comfortable with someone who seems less emotionally invested in the sale. Sales professionals who do nothing but sell every day are far better at camouflaging that eagerness to close the deal than the ordinary individual who only very occasionally sells his or her house or car. People are also uneasy about others who appear overeager to become friendly. Premature use of first names or other very informal salutations, like using someone's nickname before having been invited to do so, can have the same effect. There may well be someone with whom you could do some deal. Perhaps it might be the opportunity to moonlight for him and bring some of your work skills to bear on some problem he is encountering. Perhaps it might be a possible deal whereby you become partners in an enterprise where he invests some of his capital and you invest your knowledge and effort. Whatever it is, your chances of establishing the link that allows the other person to comfortably say to himself, "Maybe I can profit from some interaction with this person," will be improved if you do not come across as desperately needy. One of the very best ways of overcoming the appearance of desperate eagerness is to make yourself feel rich. If you were rich, then another deal would be nice, but not crucial. That is exactly the perception the other party should have of you. That way she will say to herself, "What can he do for me?" However, if you come across as needy and desperate, She is saying to herself, I wonder what he wants from me. This is why one of the most used sales techniques is to suggest an urgency. For instance, this sale ends at midnight tonight, or this is the very last suit in this color that I have left. That immediately turns the tables. Now it is no longer a desperate salesperson pushing a product. It is more a case of an increasingly desperate customer, you, hoping the kind, helpful salesperson will get you the product you want. You have suddenly been transformed into a very compliant customer. That salesperson was transformed into a bigger person, somebody who could do something for you, rather than someone who wanted to separate you from your money. Similarly, if you had some magical method of turning yourself into a larger, non-desperate kind of person, someone who was seen to be more of a giver than a taker, your business interactions would dramatically improve. If you somehow genuinely felt yourself to be a bigger person than you might really be, the perception of you would change until you had effectively made yourself bigger. One of the popular ways to accomplish this is by spending money. Buying things does tend to make people feel good because it makes them feel larger. After all, everyone knows that the customer is king. You have wandered from store to store, dispersing largesse from your wallet or by allowing imprints of your credit card. No surprise you are feeling like a benefactor. Salespeople have prostrated themselves at your feet, making you feel like a monarch. Buying things does impart a subtle feeling of control that is very welcome, particularly if you are feeling at all unsure of yourself. Acquiring things has the effect of expanding your envelope, as it were. Coming home laden down with boxes of new purchases makes me feel a little larger of a person, which is a welcome feeling. Needless to say, new purchases also satisfy that human part that seeks novelty and finds gratification in the untasted, the untouched, and the never before previously owned. The only problem with trying to gain psychic importance by buying things is that the effect is very short-lived and is invariably followed by a psychic setback. Some call it buyer's remorse. The novelty part of the thrill, which is similar to a drug-induced rush, quickly wears off because the purchase doesn't remain new for very long. The feeling of bigness wears off, too, because deep down you know you have just been indulging yourself. It is hard to fool your inner self that embarking on a buying spree for some new clothing or new toys is the activity of choice for great people. The feeling you get from buying gifts is quite different. This is why purchasing presents for others is such a popular activity. In the longer run, it imparts far more genuine pleasure than buying things for yourself. Year after year, I was told by countless callers to my radio show that their favorite aspect of the Christmas holiday season was buying presents for friends and family. How honest they were. Buying gifts for others is actually more satisfying than buying for yourself. When trying to generate an internal feeling of magnanimity and largeness, is there an alternative to shopping? The very best way to come across to others as fair-minded, big-spirited benefactor, rather than as a desperate little person, is to become a regular contributor to charities. To be sure, not only will this have you coming across as a larger person, but in fact, it will make you become a larger person. You will feel large, benevolent, and expansive, instead of desperate, mean-spirited, and petty. Of course, I'm not suggesting that mean-spiritedness is one's natural demeanor, but there are times when everyone feels intense economic pressure, At times like that, it becomes easy, indeed almost natural, to begin feeling resentful toward others less pressured in this way. You can easily develop a bit of an entitlement mindset, which makes you focus on yourself and your needs rather than on others and their needs. These conditions are easy to slide into, and they are easy for others to identify in you. They also make you far less desirable as business acquaintances and potential partners. It takes action to avoid sliding down the spiritual gravity slope of self-centeredness at times of personal need. Giving away money is one of the most powerful of all actions that defeats this dangerous tendency. It makes other people want to interact with you. Give money, not just to do good, but to do well. Now, I must take a moment to make something very clear. While I may have my own personal beliefs, for the purpose of this book, I am not urging you to be more charitable because I want to see the poor and needy provided for. I'm not even suggesting that giving money away will cause God to smile on you and reward you with wealth. I am urging you to give money away because it is one of the most powerful and effective ways of increasing your own income. As a religious Jew, it does not surprise me at all that a benevolent God arranges things in such a way that groups who follow a biblical blueprint tend to thrive. But that is not the point. My point right now is to discuss with you the mechanism by means of which charitable giving will affect your income, and thus to astound you. I have already presented to you the first consequence of giving some of your money away. Doing so makes you feel a better person, which makes you come across as a better person. This potent point is presented in the Bible during the account of the spies returning from their furtive tour of the Promised Land to report to Moses. In general, their report was gloomy and indicated deep doubt on the part of the spies about Israel's future prospects of conquest. The land may be good, they conceded, but it is populated by mighty warriors living in fortified cities. There we saw the great Nephilim people, giants from among them. We felt like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and that is how we appeared to them in their eyes too. Jewish tradition asks how these cowardly spies could possibly have known how they appeared in the eyes of the local inhabitants. Nobody really knows how others view him or her. The answer serves as a valuable warning for all time. If you feel like a grasshopper, then you will most certainly appear to be one from the perspective of those around you. If you feel desperate, and then consequently perhaps a little self-focused, then that is exactly how you will appear in the eyes of those around you. Too bad people don't really like doing business or having any other close contact with individuals who radiate selfishness. If you don't want to come across to others as a grasshopper, take care not to feel like one. This is easier said than done. How can you avoid feeling a bit like a grasshopper when you are feeling heavy pressures? Avoid it by giving money away. Now, at this stage, you might be thinking that you would rather find a less expensive way to adjust your internal mood so it will, in turn, adjust the mood you radiate to others. Good luck. By the way, should you succeed, write to me at the address at the back of this book and let me know. I will include it in future editions. Be aware, however, that the several thousand years of accumulated and recorded experience that constitutes the extant body of Jewish wisdom suggests you will be wasting your time in this quest. Being charitable means making new friends. Boosting your mood is not the only way in which giving money away works, to increase your own revenue by amounts way beyond the sums you donated. There is a second way in which this mechanism works its magic. You see, it is tough to give money away without becoming involved with many other people. I'm sure you could manage to find a way to help out a solitary friend in need here, or to make an anonymous gift to some needy associate over there. But you need a way to give away money methodically. Don't forget, you are not running a charitable foundation. You are running your own business, You, Inc. You don't have the time constantly to be seeking worthy recipients for your largesse and to be administering the effective use of the funds. You have business to take care of. So, you need help. Fortunately, help is available in dozens of different varieties. There are religious organizations, educational organizations, cultural, medical, and civic service organizations, and many other types of non-profit organizations. There is one additional great advantage to delivering your voluntary charitable contributions through a non-profit organization. The Jewish legal codifier, Moses Maimonides, ranks various acts of charitable giving. The highest rank is putting the recipient in business for himself, thus making him independent of charity. The next highest rank is giving money to someone who needs it in such a way that neither the donor nor the recipient is aware of one another's identities. This maintains total dignity. By associating with a charitable organization, you know which groups your organization has chosen to help, but you probably don't know the identity of specific recipients. Likewise, the recipient may know she is being aided by your group, but she remains unaware of the identity of any of her specific benefactors. Pick one organization with which to associate significantly. By significantly, I mean that you will invest both time and money. Select one that meets regularly and whose other members are people you would like to get to know. It is not difficult to peruse the names of those who are active in each charitable organization in your city. Get to know who is who. Feel no compunction about picking an organization on the basis of which group's members are in the best position to advance your business objectives. Selfish? Of course not. I'm talking about positioning yourself to give money away. Will it benefit you, too? Obviously, it will. What do you think I've been talking about? The entire point is that God set things up so as to make human interaction beneficial for all. So now, you have joined the Rotary Club, the local hospital support group, Habitat for Humanity, the fundraising arm of a church ministry, the art museum, or some other organization. You have paid the hefty initiation fee, which is, of course, tax-deductible. Now you must attend meetings, join committees, and do anything else to make yourself useful, helpful, and noticed. You will find yourself making new friends and acquaintances. If you have heeded the advice from this book's second commandment, you have proclaimed your professional identity quite clearly, so your new friends and acquaintances know exactly what you can do for them. That is obviously very important. Meanwhile, all this social interaction is taking place in an environment of selflessness. You are all there out of your concern for other human beings. That makes for a warm atmosphere, and accounts for why so many of the most glittering events on your city's social calendar revolve around charitable causes. People all look their best when not behaving predatorily. Business is usually not conducted at these events, and rightly so. However, more than just a few business lunches are scheduled as a result of chance encounters during charitable support work. Rest assured that in very little time you will be involved in transactions,